Hello, this is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with plain snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, this week I'm going to read articles from the most current Mojo Magazine, March 2025 issue. I'm going to start off with an article about Ringo Starr's new country album, and then an article about Jesse Ed Davis and a classic album review of another favorite of mine, Haraja by Joni Mitchell. And we start off with the article about Ringo Starr and his new country album titled Star Quality. For seven decades, the world has loved Ringo Starr, the Beatle who seemed bemused yet unaltered by mind-blowing fame. A new album has seen him reconnect with the music that started it all in a Liverpool cinema in the 1940s. Time to Talk Country, The Beatles' Demise, Solo Success, and A Lifelong Affinity with America. Who knew it was going to be so huge? He asked Tom Doyle. Autumn 1969, and Ringo Starr is sat in the expansive garden of his Brookfield mansion in Surrey, contemplating his uncertain future. All through the month of September, the fate of the Beatles had hung in the balance. At a band meeting at the Apple offices on the 8th, the mood had been upbeat, John Lennon even suggesting a formula to ease the creative tensions: a new 14-track album for possible release in 1970 to feature four songs apiece by himself, Paul, and George, and two by Ringo, if he wants them. 12 days later, at a second meeting on September the 20th, Lennon's mood had turned, likely emboldened by the success of the Plastic Ono Band's live debut in Toronto. In the interim, he had veered from peacemaker to provocateur, declaring, "The group's over, I'm leaving." 9 days on, with the news of the breakup hidden from the public, the elegant swan song that was Abbey Road arrived in record shops. All in all, it was an intense period that Starr would later describe as wholly traumatic for him. "When it was over, I had to sit around the garden and think, I know, I'll just enjoy the sun or a joint," he tells Mojo Today with a laugh. "And then I thought, nah, come on, you gotta get up." Starr wasn't idle for long, but notably, he didn't foresee an ongoing career path as a drummer in a different group. "No, I didn't think like that at all," he instantly responds. At the end of a 7-year period in which he had sung and written key Beatles songs and became the enduring standout character in all of their films, he envisioned a musical future for himself as a solo artist in parallel with the screen acting career that saw him that same year, starring opposite Peter Sellers in surreal prankster caper, The Magic Christian. By the end of October 1969, Starr was back in the studio, recasting himself as a crooner. Having called up trusted Beatle producer George Martin, he was set in motion the making of an album of pre-rock and roll standards. Night and Day, Whispering Grass, Don't Tell the Trees, even Bye Bye Blackbird. that had the glam foreshadowing working title of Ringo Stardust, but which was released on Apple in March 1970 under the name Sentimental Journey. Where I come from, there was a lot of parties and everybody had to sing a song, he explains, and these were all the songs that I'd heard, mainly at our house or anybody's house you went to. Still, as the first Beatle to make a solo bid for mainstream success, as opposed to arty kudos, it was a slightly bizarre move in the era of long-haired confessional troubadours and progressive heavy rockers. Slightly less anachronistic, but way more fitting, was its successor, which arrived only 6 months later. Bo Coops of Blues was a full-scale realization of Starr's early years passion for country and an album-length exploration of the style he'd tapped into in The Beatles, with everything from Act Naturally to Octopus's Garden. It came about, strangely enough, as the result of an airport pickup Starr did as a favor to Harrison, sending his driver to collect U.S. pedal steel player Pete Drake to take him to the sessions for All Things Must Pass. Drake noticed that Starr kept a collection of country cassettes in the car. When he got to the studio, he said, "Hey boss, I see you like country music." Ringo remembers the next day he was talking to me about going to Nashville. "Let's make a record." And I was like, "Oh, I don't think so. How long have I got to be there?" "Nothing against Nashville, just like, I don't think so." Drake convinced Starr by telling him that when he'd played on Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline the previous year, the sessions had lasted only a matter of days. So I said, "Okay," and I got to Nashville on Monday. We picked 5 songs on Tuesday in the morning, and in the afternoon and evening, we recorded them. And we did the same the next day, and it was over in 2 days. Accompanied by an album cover image of Starr holding a cigarette, looking appropriately fed up, perched on the stoop of a smokehouse shed, most of the tracks on Bay Coop of Blues were sung in a gentle, lovelorn tone that turned rousing when required. It was a solid diversion into a different kind of genre album that scaled to a respectable number 35 on the U.S. country chart. Moreover, it proved that Ringo Starr was country to his soul and somehow hardwired to this emotionally direct music. "Well, yeah, I am an emotional guy," he states, before checking himself. "I can't wait for those headlines," laughs heartily, "but I am in a way." Bright and early on a Tuesday morning, Ringo Starr is in his Rockabella West home studio in Los Angeles. His demeanor chipper, his appearance dapper, shades and beard, black teddy, boy-style jacket with popped white-trimmed collar, purple cameo t-shirt, and peace sign pendant. "I'm great," he offers, like Tony the Tiger, with an exaggerated scouse blur, as he greets Mojo. Indeed, other than the word and twanged to end theirs, very little Californian corruption of his seemingly indelible Liverpool 8 accent. At the age of 84, at least on today's evidence, he remains irrepressibly a blueblint. Along a wall hang assorted items of memorabilia from his long and mind-boggling career. A 70s-era Black Gibson SG electric guitar adorned with silver stars, a circular clock featuring the image of himself and his fellow Fabs as seen on the cover of 2013 Beatles Compt On Air Live at the BBC Volume 2. One significant frame contains an original ticket for his first official gig in the Fabulous Beatles Band, Saturday, August 18th, 1962, at an after-show dance on the Whirl held by the Port Sunlight Horticulture Society in a bloom-festooned home hall. We're here chiefly to celebrate the fact that, a mere 55 years after Bo Cupa Blues, Starr has made a follow-up country album, Look Up, produced and largely written by T-Bone Burnett. It's his best record in years, not least because Burnett has tastefully matched Ringo's vocal performances with simpaccato foils, Alison Krauss, Molly Tuttle, Billy Strings, and lyrically tried to get inside Starr's head. I was trying to write in his voice and into his aesthetic, Burnett tells Mojo. I just wanted to do something that was true to him. Friends since the 70s, the pair bumped into one another in Los Angeles in 2022. Ringo inviting Burnett to write a song for him for what was originally intended to be a country EP. Tapping into Starr's most formative of musical influences, Burnett says, I wrote him a Gene Autry song in the shape of lonesome ballad, Come Back. For Starr, this beautiful song zapped him back to the 40s when 8-year-old Ricky Starkey at the Pictures in Liverpool saw Audrey sing his piny 1939 cowboy ballad, South of the Border, in the film of the same name. Gene Autry knocked me away, Ringo enthuses now, almost 8 decades on from that childhood epiphany. It was so far out. That's the first, like, memory of a musical moment. Aw, and I loved it. I love the guys either side of him. All on horses. It was a magical moment. As this new Starr/Burnett country project rapidly developed from extended play to full album, the latter expanded the stylistic range, exploring the rockabilly vibes he heard on early Beatles records. George and Ringo were the most rockabilly of the group, Burnett argues, citing their various readings of Carl Perkins songs, including Starr's gusty takes on Matchbox on 1964's Long Tall Sally EP, and on Beatles for Sale, Honey Don't. So I thought I would take that tack, and I wrote him a song called Never Let Me Go. That's a straight-up rockabilly song. Then he just kept asking for songs, and I kept finding things to write about, parts of what I knew about him. For the young Richard Starkey, Gene Autry provided a gateway into country music, leading him to explore the songs of Hank Williams and Hank Snow, and venture further into the country blues of Lightning Hopkins. So inspired was he by the latter that, in his late teens, he even explored the possibility of relocating to his hero's home state of Texas. He and a friend picked up immigration forms from the American Consulate in Liverpool and wrote a letter to the Houston Chamber of Commerce looking for factory jobs. In the end, he was frustrated by the seemingly endless paperwork. "They gave us a list of factories we could apply to," Starr remembers, "and then we went back to say, we've done these forms. And they gave us more forms. We ripped them up and got on with our lives." For Starr and his Beatle bandmates, the very act of visiting America in 64 was a mind blower in itself. Even before they knew anything of the seismic effect they would have on the country. Today, Ringo can only describe the experience in almost cartoonish or supernatural terms. "I felt, even on the plane coming into New York, it was like an octopus put its arms around the plane and brought us down," he laughs. To go to America was really far out. Starr's love for America was quickly returned when he proved to be the most popular Beatle in the U.S. He was short and cuddly looking, with a runtish charm and a wisecracking personality. "Ringo, why do you get the most fan mail?" "I don't know, perhaps 'cause more people write to me." Through 1964 and 65, Starr was the subject of a flood of novelty singles Rush released in his honor, including the Phil Spector-produced Cher-sung Ringo, I Love You. There was even a mock protest staged outside the 1964 Republican National Convention in Daly City, California, involving students holding banners demanding Ringo for president. T-Bone Burnett also points to the montage scene in A Hard Day's Night, where Ringo escapes the mad cyclone of Beatlemania and goes on a solo walkout in London, wistfully snapping photographs as being crucial to his appeal. "There was this tremendous pathos that came through that," he says, "in the midst of all this hilarity and mania. He had this beautiful, quiet spirit." That crazy storm was encapsulated by the scenes at London's airport on October 31st, 1963. By chance, as the Beatles deplaned after a trip from Sweden, the feral fan scenes were witnessed by CBS TV host Ed Sullivan. Astonished, Sullivan would unveil the band to more than 73 million Americans on February the 9th, 1964. "Ed Sullivan was getting off another plane from New York," recalls Starr. "He didn't know us. We'd never heard of him, and he sort of booked us. And, you know, by the time we got to America, we had a number one with I Want to Hold Your Hand, which was far out. Who knew it was going to be so huge?" he adds, still disbelievingly. "You know, you cannot plan that." It's perhaps no surprise that when the Beatles broke up, Starr wanted to step fully into the spotlight. Ringo was never afraid to front a tune, going back to his Starr time, turns on stage with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes at Butlins, where he would belt out the Shirelles' Boys from Behind the Kit. Looking back, he puts his early confidence as a singer down to youthful naivety and exuberance. "You don't know any better," he grins. "That's what's great. Oh, okay, I'll sing some now." And that's what we did. Then with the Beatles, they would give me one track, an album, and they all had a country feel. And then I started writing, and it seemed to fit the country style. For Broken-Hearted Shuffler, What Goes On, from Rubber Soul, The drummer earned a Lennon/McCartney/Starkey writing credit split after suggesting what he estimated to be about 5 words for the lyric. Meanwhile, Starr's first solo writing contribution to the Beatles, the country lope of Don't Pass Me By, had long been in development before it was recorded for the White Album in 1968. As early as July 1964, in a Beatles interview on BBC radio show Top Gear, there was a reference made to the song presenter Brian Matthew inquired, "Ringo, how about your songwriting? How's that coming on?" "Oh yes, I've written a good one," the drummer brightly responded, "but nobody seems to want to record it." After a comedy argument between Starr and McCartney, the latter began singing the first line of the chorus of Don't Pass Me By, and then mugged through the rest of it in a cornball American accent. Today, Ringo's strongest memory of Don't Pass Me By is coming up with the song's verses while sitting alone at the piano in his Sunny Heights home in Surrey, sometime in late 1965. And here's a little bit of that Beatles song, Don't Pass Me By.
I listen for your footsteps coming up the drive. Listen for your footsteps, but they don't arrive. Waiting for your knock, dear, on my old front door. I don't hear it. Does it mean you don't love me anymore? I hear the clock a ticking on the mantel shelf. See the hands are moving, but I'm by myself. I wonder where you are tonight, and why I'm by myself. I don't see you. Does it mean you don't love me anymore? Don't pass me by, don't make me cry, don't make me blue.
Nobody was in the house, and I was listening for your footsteps coming up the drive. You know, I'm sitting here all alone. So, the opening verse is literal? Laughs. Yeah, that's how it came. Birthday evidence of Starr's ongoing songwriting endeavors during the era arrived in 2021 with Get Back. Peter Jackson's eye-opening recruit of the Let It Be footage. In one memorable Apple Studio scene, Ringo asked George, "Have you heard the Octopus one?" before playing rudimentary piano and singing what he has so far of Octopus's Garden, as Harrison picks up a guitar and helps his bandmate shape the chord sequence. "I loved it," Starr says of the scene. "George is just sort of hanging out, and I'm going, I'd like to be G minor," laughs, B7. Whatever he was shouting, I can only play in C. Ever supportive of Ringo, Harrison didn't feel the need to take a writing credit for that song or for Starr's first solo hit, It Don't Come Easy, number 4 in 1971, in both the UK and US, which he officially produced while playing a fugitive hand in its composition. In an effective revival of his Starr Time feature spots on stage at the Harrison-organized benefit Concert for Bangladesh shows at Madison Square Garden on August 1, 1971, Ringo sang the song from behind the drums, prompting an enormous roar from the crowd. Here's a little bit of that Ringo Starr song, It Don't Come Easy. I think he was nervous, says Klaus Voormann. Beetle Pal, says Hamburg. Revolver cover illustrator and bassist for the Bangladesh shows. The nice thing was that he had Jim Keltner playing drums next to him, and he was actually giving him confidence. Keltner himself is taking no credit, however. I never saw any kind of nervousness from him, laughs the legendary sideman. No, he'd been around for a long while up to that point. Ringo always had the confidence that we should all have. As the early 70s progressed, Ringo was to exert a magnetic pull on his former bandmates, who, like Harrison, were always happy to lend a hand on his solo records. On 1973's Ringo LP, he even managed to reunite all four Beatles, although not all together in the same studio, or even on the same track. McCartney wrote and played on mid-paced piano ballad 6 O'Clock, while Harrison and Lennon performed together on the Lennon-penned comedy brag of I'm the Greatest. Jim Keltner was invited to play drums side by side with Starr on Ringo, and during the sessions witnessed both intra-Beatle rivalry and almost bloody loyalty. I think that it'd be accurate to say they were competitive, he offers, but they never lost the love and respect for each other. I know that. I saw that firsthand. If they said something funny about one of the others, and then I would do it, they would say, no, we can do that, Jim, but you can't. That was a total family thing. A decade and a half later, Jim Keltner, my favorite drummer, says Ringo, was one of the first people Starr called in 1989 when, having gone through rehab for alcoholism, he decided to put a new band together and get back on the road. He changed when he got completely clean, says Keltner. He always had a good heart, but never was mean-spirited or egocentric. But he got more accessible. He got more real in his friendliness when he got sober. Ringo says his decision to gather together a touring supergroup around him, the All-Star Band, was partly down to insecurity. I just never wanted to be that guy in the front for the whole show, he admits. At the same time, he remembers being genuinely surprised when everyone he called up instantly accepted the gig. I just went through my phone book. Oh, Joe Walsh, yeah. Levon Helm, yeah. Rick Danko, yeah, you know. Dr. John, well, it was a bit interesting with him. I was in Monte Carlo, and I called him, and we had a friend helping us. And after the phone call, I said, I don't think Mac wants to be in the band. The go-between later told Starr he had received a call from Dr. John, who was equally convinced that by the end of their conversation, Ringo didn't want him involved. The problem, it transpired, had been a miscommunication due to the pair's clashing Liverpool/New Orleans accents. He was difficult sometimes to understand, Ringo laughs. Joe Walsh remembers that when the stellar lineup was completed by Niles Lofgren, Billy Preston, and Clarence Clemens, Starr said to him, "Now, what do we do?" He never thought anybody would say yes. I mean, it was just a concept in his head. And you know, turning a concept into something real takes some work. The All-Star Band began touring in 1989 and haven't really stopped since, abet an amorphous form. Down the years, John Entwistle, Todd Rundgren, Ian Hunter, and Sheila E. have all passed through its ranks. While in its current form, it features Men at Work's Colin Hay and the Average White Band's Hamish Stewart. "I still love to play," Ringo says, "and I get a chance to play to all their songs. And I get a chance to play a couple of my songs and drums. And then I go down the front, and I'm the guy in the front." Klaus Voormann guested with the All-Star Band on stage in Hamburg in 2018, adding his voice to the chorus of "With a Little Help from My Friends," and attest to the uplifting power of the show. "It's great to get these people together, and they all have fun, and the public gets not just Ringo, they get a variety of different hits. It's a great idea." As to what still drives Starr to remain an active touring musician in his 80s, Joe Walsh says, well, he's not really interested in being more famous, but he's not done playing. Neither is Paul. Starr, however, admits that, in his advanced years, maintaining a functioning singing voice on tour can sometimes be a challenge. "Well, it gets worn out very fast," he says. "I mean, I can get through the show. I have a singing exercise tape that a guy gave me in 1989, and I put that on." Sings downscale, "No, no, 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 no." A lot of high notes. Whee! In Thankful, Starr's sole writing contribution with Bruce Sugar to Look Up, Ringo has recorded what T-Bone Burnett reckons is the most personal song he's ever done. In its lyric, he refers to troubled times in the past when he turned away from all the things that mattered, before declaring that love for his wife of 43 years, Barbara Bach, has made him a better man, and happily announcing, "It's a beautiful day here in California." Having lived in Los Angeles on and off since 1973, Starr became a permanent resident in 2014 after selling up his last Surrey home, Rydenhurst. For a kid growing up in a wartime and post-war Liverpool, did California seem like paradise? "Well, when I first came to America and we landed in New York, I wanted to live in New York," he says. "And then we went on tours around and we'd come to L.A. I'd think, maybe L.A. No, New York. Maybe L.A. Decisively, L.A. I just love the atmosphere. I love the light. I love the heat." Not that Ringo ever felt the urge to head out into the surf. "It took me 7 years to go to the ocean," he chuckles. "A limo took me down to the Pacific Coast Highway. I got out of the car, walked across the beach, put my feet in the water, turned around, walked back to the car, and went for lunch." Famously, Star's lunch these days is super healthy and heavy on the broccoli and blueberries, which accounts, alongside regular exercise, for his remarkable octogenarian fitness. At recent shows, he's even performed Star Jumps on stage. Expect more when the All-Star Band return to the road for two U.S. tours in 2025. Yep, he's totally taken care of himself, attests Joe Walsh, and he yells at me when I don't. In a surprise twist in 2008, Walsh became Star's brother-in-law after marrying Barbara Bach's sister, Marjorie. We're pretty much best friends and all, but still, sometimes I look over and I go, holy shit, one of the Beatles. I just can't help it, you know? He's just bigger than life. I just can't believe that somebody who's been through what he's been through can be so tuned in and down to earth and a really good guy. The world's fascination with Richard Starkey, the man whose mind-blowing fame and cultural revolutions seemed powerless to change, will continue, with luck, for some time yet. As ever, the man himself is unwilling or incapable of accounting for it. I feel blessed. I just think sometimes I make the right moves, he concludes with humble understatement, before offering up one of his famous Ringo-isms. You know, I make more right moves than left moves. And here's a little bit of the song Breathless from Ringo Starr off of his newest album titled Look Up. And now the article about Jesse Ed Davis, titled Red Dirt Boogie Brother. Unsung guitar hero Jesse Ed Davis is saluted in an exhibition and tribute show. But who was he? Famous friends tell all. It's kind of a mystery when somebody plays that stirringly, Jackson Browne tells Mojo, grappling with the inspiring yet ultimately tragic puzzle that was Jesse Ed Davis. The Native American guitarist and songwriter, by appointment to Browne, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and more, is the subject of current exhibition Jesse Ed Davis, Natural Anthems, at the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's accompanied by a new biography, Douglas K. Miller's Washika Love Child, The Rise of Indigenous Rock Star Jesse Ed Davis, and capped off by a February 6 concert at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center featuring Browne, Davis's one-time bandleader Taj Mahal, former U.S. poet laureate Joy Harjo, and ex-members of the Graffiti Manned Band. The misspelling was a goof that stuck. Who played with Davis and spoken word artist John Trudell. Davis was preternaturally gifted. Intuitive is the adjective so many use to describe his talent. He was a genius, says Eric Clapton of his friend, years ahead of his time. like Trudell and Harjo, Davis was Native American, a background that influenced his personality and music. He would go on to play on over 100 LPs and with an extraordinary list of three Beatles, Dylan, Rod Stewart, and the Faces, Leonard Cohen, and Clapton, and was on the Stones' subs bench when Keith Richards faced possible prison on drug charges. Born and raised in Oklahoma, Davis had begun his professional career playing in rockabilly star Conway Twitty's band. Through Twitty's close friend, Ronnie Hawkins, Davis became pals with the Hawks' Robbie Robertson and Levon Helm. After Davis quit Twitty and moved to Los Angeles, Helm introduced him to Leon Russell, another Okie connected with the Wrecking Crew. It was through Russell that Davis began playing sessions. The blues was Davis's musical language, Jackson Brown. He was based in the blues he played so emotionally. There's no one who can tell you why he played that way, though he was an incredibly talented young guy who played in roadhouses and bars with black people and white people who loved the blues. Among his strengths was the immediacy of his response to what he was hearing. While Taj Mahal was signed to Columbia Records, Davis became his co-musical director, admired for his searing Telecaster tone and mellifluous bottleneck technique. When guitarist Dwayne Allman had a cold, his brother Greg brought him Mahal's first LP and a bottle of cortisone, cold pills. Inspired by Davis's playing and using the empty pill bottle as a slide, Dwayne's signature Allman Brothers sound was born. When Davis, Taj Mahal, and a band played the Whiskey a Go-Go in 1968, they looked out on the dance floor. Mick Jagger's dancing, remembers Taj. Keith Richards and Brian Jones are dancing. Soon afterwards, plane tickets arrived at the group's management office and band and crew headed to London to appear in the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus TV concert. At the filming, Davis became pals with John Lennon and Clapton, friendships that would endure. After Davis left Mahal, he played at George Harrison's concert for Bangladesh. Then Clapton called Jerry Wexler and secured Davis a contract with Atlantic, Altico's subsidiary. His first solo LP, Jesse Davis, featured sublime guitar playing and his laconic draw on autobiographical songs, including Watch the Love Child. Clapton, Leon Russell, Graham Parsons, and others contributed. The follow-up, Ultra and Keep Me Comin', were equally soulful and featured marquee guests, among them Harrison and Dr. John.
And here's a little bit of that song, Washita Love Child, with Eric Clapton, by Jesse Ed Davis.
Baptized my airbag, and I did that.
session work was Davis's bread and butter. He played on Dylan's Watching the River Flow single, Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night, Gonna Be All Right, and Jackson Browne's Doctor My Eyes. His solo on the latter still amazes Browne. He did it in one pass. He just plugged in, played the solo, and we said, "We want you to play at the end too." We queued it up, and he played the end. Everything he played on that record came without a listen through. He just played it. He was so intuitive, free and spontaneous. He elevated what was being said in the song. And here's a little bit of that song from Jackson Browne, Doctor My Eyes.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what is wrong. Was I unwise to leave them open for so long?
After touring with Rod Stewart and the Faces in 1975, his fondness for drugs became a heroin addiction. Then, while living in a Native American halfway house, after cleaning up, he met poet activist John Trudell. Together, they released a cassette called AKA Graffiti Man that Bob Dylan dubbed the best album of 1986 in Rolling Stone. Jesse fashioned musical figures for Trudell that held the words and let you hear them, says Browne. It's that American blues that allows you to tell the truth. On June 22, 1988, Jesse Ed Davis was found dead of a drug overdose in the laundry room of his apartment building, age 43. Drummer and fellow Oklahoman Jim Keltner, Davis's bandmate on countless sessions, believes John Lennon's murder contributed to Davis's depression and demise. John sent a mimeograph letter to me, Jesse and Klaus Voorman, saying he wanted to make a rock and roll record with us, recalls Keltner. Playing with John was special for all of us, but especially for Jesse, because he knew how much John loved his playing. I feel Jesse just gave up. February 6's tribute concert is an overdue acknowledgement of Davis's role in rock music history. Hopefully, it won't be the last.
And here's another Jesse Ed Davis song titled Every Night is a Saturday Night.
Classic album review this week is another one of my favorites, Hejira by Joni Mitchell, 1976. In 1974, Joni Mitchell sat at the apex of pop music of the pop music universe, adorned by most critics and millions of fans for a series of brilliant, often achingly personal albums, a run that culminated that year with the monster hit Court and Spark. She then had the nerve to follow her muse into a smoky, jazz-drenched dive, a journey that led her most supple and graceful album, Horizon. Composed on the road, it is the only Mitchell album on which every tune is written on and for the guitar. The name stems from the Prophet Muhammad's journey of exile from Mecca to Medina. In Mitchell's case, Horizon traces a cross-country road trip sparked by the end of an affair. The album marks the beginning of the singer-songwriter's profound relationship with the pioneering electric bassist Jaco Pastorius. While Pastorius's genius fully flowered in the fusion supergroup Weather Report, he never played more beautifully than in the confines of a stripped-down, tightly constructed, 5-minute Mitchell epic, like the opening track, Coyote.
And here's a little bit of that song, Coyote, by Joni Mitchell from her album, Horizon.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be brushing out a broodmare's tail while the sun is ascending, and I'll just be getting home with my reel-to-reel. There's no comprehending just how close to the bone and the skin and the eyes and the lips you can get and still feel so alone and still feel related like stations in some relay. You're not a hit-and-run driver, no, no, racing away. You just picked up a hitcher, prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. You saw a farmhouse burning down in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. We rolled right past that tragedy till we turned into some roadhouse lights where a local band was playing. Locals were up kicking and shaking on the floor. The next thing I know, that coyote's at my door. He pins me in a corner, he won't take no. He drags me out on the dance floor and we're dancing close and slow. Now he's got
his supple melodic lines serve as a burnished counterpoint to her increasingly rich soprano, reaching a graceful climax on the mysteriously affecting Amelia, a song that traces an arc of romantic discovery with references to previous tunes Woodstock, Both Sides Now, and Cactus Tree. And here's a little bit of the song Amelia by Joni Mitchell from her album Horizon.
I was driving across the burning desert when I spotted six jet planes leaving six white vapor trails across the bleak terrain. It was the hexagram of the heavens. It was the strings of my guitar. Amelia, it was just a false alarm. Song so wild and blue, it scrambled. his sad request of me to kindly stay away. So this is how I hide the hurt as the road leads cursed and charmed.
Mitchell made more ambitious and popular albums, but with its vivid imagery, poetic scope, and emotional insight, Haraja stands as a perfect meeting of instrumental veracity and confessional storytelling. Once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the most current March 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article, 1965 in 45s, 20 subversive singles from 1965. And then a review of an officially endorsed documentary about Jeff Buckley, who passed away in 1997. And a classic album review of Transformer by Lou Reed. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music, saying so long. And keep rockin'.